They say fame is addictive. I say it's a curse wrapped in dopamine and dipped in illusion. It all started with a lie. I told my audience I was in a penthouse suite overlooking Manhattan, when in truth, I was in my mom's basement in Jersey, surrounded by LED lights, a green screen, and a few rented props off Craigslist. The champagne bottle behind me? Apple cider. The city lights? A looping video from YouTube. But the lie worked. Thousands tuned in. My following exploded. I was Daniel Cruz, your favorite wild, edgy, viral king. Every stream, every post, every prank was a chance to push the envelope. That night, I had 76,000 people watching live. The chat was a riot of emojis, LOLs, and fire emojis. I was killing it. Until Nolan walked in. My cousin, barefoot, hoodie half-zipped, carrying a USPS box with our real address taped on it. Yo, Daniel, your package came in. The camera caught it all. The box, the label, the lie. The chat turned in seconds. Fake as fuck. Basement boy. Fraud Neil. I watched it crumble in real time. My DMs were full of laughing GIFs. YouTube was already stitching it with clown music. I wanted to scream. I wanted to burn everything down. But most of all, I wanted my followers back. So I did the only thing I knew how to do. Plan the next big stunt. Nolan was my cousin, sure. But he was more than that. He was a dork. Naive. Always trusting. He thought I was some kind of genius. He looked up to me. That was his first mistake. He didn't mean to ruin anything. But when you're bleeding followers and losing brand deals overnight, intent doesn't mean shit. I told him that we're doing a mystery sandwich challenge. He grinned. You sure your followers want to see me again after that last mess? Totally, I said, forcing a smile. Redemption arc, bro. People eat that up. I prepped the sandwiches. Mine was normal. His was laced with Visine. Old internet lore said it just gave you diarrhea. I figured he'd puke, maybe cry a little, and the comments would eat it up. I forgot to Google if people could be allergic. I forgot a lot of things. The stream started like any other. What's up, fam? It's your boy, Danny Danger. And today, we got my cousin, Noli, back for a mystery munch. I beamed, tapping at the mic. Redemption time. Nolan chuckled, taking a bite. Tastes like garbage already, he joked, chewing. I laughed. The chat lit up. Then he coughed. Then he collapsed. I stared at the camera, frozen. For a split second, I thought he was playing along. By the way his body twisted, the way he clawed at his throat, this wasn't acting. Nolan, I whispered. The comments flooded in. WTF is happening. Call 911. Is this part of it? It wasn't. The ambulance came fast. Cops, even faster. By morning, hashtags like hashtag live murder and hashtag Danny Dangerous was trending worldwide. Nolan lived, barely. He had a rare allergy to tetrahydrozoline. I didn't even know what that meant until the lawyer read it off the affidavit. They arrested me on camera. My last stream was a mugshot. But there's the thing that no one talks about. Once you fed the beast of fame, silence feels like death. In jail, I paced like an animal. My lawyer, a public defendant who smelled like microwave burritos, said, "They're going for attempted murder. You better start praying." I didn't pray. I plotted. While the DA built their case, I went to work. I leaked an old video of Nolan saying, "I'll do anything for clout, even fake a seizure." It was a joke, of course, but out of context, the internet eats that shit up. Reddit ran with it. YouTube stitched it. Suddenly, the narrative started to splinter. Maybe Nolan faked it. Maybe it was a setup. Maybe Danny was innocent. My lawyer looked at me with disgust when the clip went viral. That stunt might have just screwed your bail hearing. But did you see the views? I said. He didn't respond. Court was a circus. The media camped outside like it was Coachella. Nolan took the stand. He looked fragile, like he aged a decade and a month. "I trusted him," he said, voice shaking. "I thought we were family." The prosecutor played the clip where I whispered, "This is going to be hilarious," right before the prank. I was screwed. Until I wasn't. The team dug deeper. We found out Nolan had been quietly monetizing his own YouTube shorts ever since the incident. Sponsorships, interviews, and suddenly a victim influencer. I took the stand. Yes, it was a prank. A stupid one. But there was no criminal intent. The jury watched a montage of Nolan smiling in post-hospital selfies. The room was split. I wasn't acquitted. But I wasn't locked up for life either. Plea deal. 2 years, probation after that. Prison was quieter than I imagined. They took away my phone, but not my brain. I started scripting, planning, thinking of how I'd enter the scene. But here's the ugly truth. Scandals don't kill fame. They feed it. Eventually, when I got out, TMZ was waiting. "Daniel, any regrets?" I looked straight to the camera. Only that I didn't monetize the trial. The reporter gasped. The clip went viral. I moved to LA and the documentaries came knocking. Stream deals, podcasts. I even got a DM from a Netflix producer. Let's talk. They called it the most Gen Z crime of the decade. They said I was a villain. I knew I was a brand. On December 13th, 2023, a Florida man was arrested for allegedly poisoning his nephew's food with Visine. James Leach, 45, purchased a meatball sandwich from a market near his Pinellas Park home and was seen on security footage pouring the eyedrop solution into the food. The store employee warned him of the potential harm, but Leach reportedly claimed that it would only make the victim sick. The nephew unknowingly consumed a portion before police intervened. While medical help was offered, he refused treatment. Leach, who had a prior criminal record, was charged with food poisoning, a felony, and held on a $50,000 bond. A judge ordered him to have no contact with the victim.
We met at a rooftop screening in Bushwick. You know, one of those artsy nights where everybody pretends they care about the film but really just want to look good under string lights. She was hot, definitely out of my league. Sipping a whiskey sour like it was a goddamn personality trait. I fell fast, hard, and stupid. I wasn't her usual type, I knew that. I could tell by the way she looked at the tall guys, the ones with the muscles, the ones who didn't read sci-fi or collect video game cartridges. But somehow I slipped through. Maybe it was the novelty, or maybe I was just convenient. I was smart, stable. I texted back, paid on time, and made her laugh. And when you've been tossed around enough by bad boys, a safe harbor looks like love. But here's the thing. I knew. 6 months later, I knew she was sleeping with someone else. Not just someone. Tyrell, 6'3", jacked like a fucking Greek statue dipped in ink. He worked at a boxing gym. I saw the text. Missed last night. The first time I saw the message, I stared at it like it was a pop-up error in my operating system. I didn't say anything. I just closed her phone, walked to the kitchen, and made coffee. I told myself, she's not yours, it's just your turn. Pathetic, right? But I stayed. Because truth is, I'm not built for the dating scene. I'm not cool, and I'm not an alpha. I'm an engineer with too many opinions about Star Trek and a metabolism that tanks at 29. Girls like her don't usually end up with guys like me unless they're slumming it for a season. And if I let her go, what would people say? My friends had already met her. My Instagram was filled with photos of us. Rooftop brunches, beach days, dumb videos of us cooking vegan pasta. I'd finally made it look like I had it together. So I let it slide. I swallowed my pride like a fucking vitamin. Then one Saturday, she sent me a link to the shop in Flatbush. Couples art, it said. Tattoos, magnets, stitching. Some kind of weird tech art hybrid place. She said it'd be fun. Something permanent. Symbolic. I thought, maybe this is her trying to fix things. Maybe she feels guilty. Or maybe, stupid as it sounds, maybe she's choosing me. So I said yes. I remember the day we got the implants like it was burned into my brain. Because it was. Like how you remember the last time you felt invincible right before the ground gave out beneath you. It was a Saturday. The city was bright. Vendors on the sidewalks, kids with blue ice pops, dogs panting in baby strollers. Brooklyn at its finest. We stepped out of the shop, arms linked like newlyweds leaving a Vegas chapel. The sign read, couples art, tattoos, magnets, and stitching. Cute, right? She laughed, I laughed. I looked at her like she was a secret I just cracked, and she smiled like she had plans. Our forearms were still warm from the procedure. The implant was simple. Nanomagnets embedded under the skin from elbow to pinky. When we raised opposite arms, they clicked together. Clean. Beautiful. A soft buzz of static.
Try not to scratch it,
the guy with the nose ring had said.
Takes a few days to settle.
We walked down Flatbush, magnetically linked, bumping into strangers and lampposts. Laughing like kids high on sugar. She talked about her screenplay. I told her she was a genius. She told me she knew. I remember the first scratch. Just a little itch. No big deal. But the second time I scratched, the magnet disengaged. I rubbed my arm and noticed a faint blue glow under the skin. A little sore from the implant, I said. She nodded. Concerned but trying not to show it. Clouds started gathering like some kind of omen. By the time we got to the coffee place on Nostrand, we were both scratching. More than casual, more like withdrawal. My skin felt like it was crawling.
Don't scratch it out,
she tried to laugh it off, but her voice wobbled. Rain began to fall, light at first. We didn't even bother with jackets. Then it got heavier. That's when it started sizzling. It wasn't immediate. Like the acid took a few seconds to realize it had something to eat. But when it did, it hissed like oil in a skillet. I screamed. She did too. Her arm was red, blistering, melting like a cheap Halloween mask.
Take it out!
She screamed, clawing at her arm. I saw the device on the counter. Mechanical. Greasy. Meant for carving more than fixing. I flipped the switch. It hummed like a meat grinder.
You don't have to...
She started, but I didn't let her finish. I couldn't. I sliced through the bone, the muscle, the goddamn lung. Our arms fell to the floor, still sizzling. And snapped together like lovers in a last embrace, like praying hands. A flyer drifted down from the counter. It had the name of the shop and other details. At the bottom, there was a note in bold letter. Caution. Only attempt if it's true love. In the year 2025, body modification enthusiast Sadie Riendo and her fiancé Hannah Hansman spent $1,000 to get magnets implanted beneath their skin that connect when they touch. Receiving mixed responses online, they shared that it causes no pain and is a marker of their love for each other. Unlike the characters in our story, this real-world couple appears to be in true love with each other, so God bless them.
I'd spent most of my life on the streets, scraping by day to day, and I was tired of it. Megan felt the same way. We'd been running scams and petty thefts together for years, but nothing big enough to change our fortunes. That's why, when Megan spotted the old man cashing a fat check at the U.S. Bank downtown, we figured it was our ticket out. The plan was simple enough. Break into his house, take whatever cash we could find, and slip out without making a scene. Emma was jittery from the start. She was always nervous about these things, but this time was worse. Still, we needed her. She had a knack for remembering details, numbers, things that could get us access to bank accounts and PIN codes. We promised her it would be easy. Around midnight, the neighborhood was quiet, houses dark and silent. We found his place easily. Big, fancy, $2,000 for an old guy living alone. The back door wasn't even locked, which we took as a sign of luck. Inside, we moved quickly, hearts thumping. Megan found a wallet with cash and cards right away, but we needed more. The elderly man woke suddenly, appearing in the doorway confused, frail but defiant.
"What the hell are you doing?"
His voice cracked, but he stepped towards Megan aggressively.
"Back off, old man," she hissed,
but he lunged, gripping her shoulder. In a panic, everything happened fast. Megan pushed. I grabbed his arms, and he swung wildly. Emma shrieked, her eyes wide with fear.
"Make him stop!" she screamed.
Instinct took over. Fear clouded my senses, and before I knew it, my hands were around his throat. Megan helped hold him down, struggling, kicking, until suddenly he went limp beneath our grip. His eyes stared blankly upwards, glassy and lifeless.
"Oh my God," Emma whispered, voice shaking. "Is he dead?"
I checked his pulse, panic rising sharply in my throat. "We killed him." Megan's voice was oddly calm, cold even. Emma started sobbing, but Megan cut her off sharply.
"Shut up! We need to think."
And that's when Megan had the craziest idea yet. "We can still get his money," she said quietly. "Banks open early. We take him with us."
"What?"
Emma gasped, horrified.
"You're crazy!"
"Think about it," Megan said, dragging the body to a chair. "We just pretend he's alive, sleeping or something. The bank people won't even notice. He's old, anyway. No one expects him to be jumping around." It was insane, but desperation makes you do insane things. We waited until dawn, keeping the body propped up, his stiffening limbs awkwardly positioned. Emma was shaking uncontrollably, but Megan kept whispering reassurance.
"It's fine, Emma. One last job and we're free."
At first light, we managed to drag the old man's body to his car, pushing him into the passenger seat. Megan adjusted him carefully, sunglasses hiding his lifeless eyes, a hat tilted low on his forehead. I drove, hands trembling, my heart racing with adrenaline and fear. We pulled into the bank's drive-thru, heartbeats louder than ever. Megan handed me the ID and the account details Emma had scribbled down. I pressed the call button, breathing heavily, sweat sliding down my back.
"Yes, sir, how can I help?"
The teller's voice crackled through the intercom.
"My grandfather needs to withdraw cash,"
I said, forcing my voice steady.
"He's not feeling well, so I'm helping him today."
There was a pause, and my throat tightened painfully. Emma whimpered softly in the back seat.
"Can I have the account information, please?"
the teller finally asked. I relayed everything Emma had remembered. Seconds ticked by painfully slow, every muscle tense as I waited.
"$5,000, correct?"
Yes, please," I said, trying to sound casual.
Moments later, cash slid through the small tray. My heart soared as Megan quickly grabbed it.
"Thank you,"
I said, voice too cheerful, and then quickly drove away.
"We did it!"
Megan shouted, laughing nervously, relief flooding through us all. Emma cried quietly in the back seat, her tears a mix of relief and guilt. We needed to ditch the body. Megan suggested leaving him at the medical center. Someone else's problem, we figured. We parked behind the emergency department, placing him carefully on a bench outside. We propped him up, trying to make him look as natural as possible, hoping someone would assume he died waiting for help. We drove off, certain we'd gotten away with it. But life never lets you off easy. Days later, police arrived at the abandoned building we'd been squatting in. The moment I saw the uniform, I knew it was over. They had footage from the bank security cameras. Everything crystal clear.
In interrogation, Emma broke first, crying hysterically, detailing everything. Megan cursed, shouting at her, but there was no point. Our fate was sealed. You girls have no idea who you killed, do you? The cop asked quietly, sliding a newspaper across the table. My eyes scanned the headline, heart freezing mid-beat. Local mob boss found dead outside hospital. Police suspect gang hit.
He was a mobster?
Megan's voice was a harsh whisper. One of the worst, the cop said back, watching our stunned faces. You stirred up a hornet's nest. Wasn't long before his associates figured it out. You're safer behind bars than on the streets right now. A cold dread filled my chest. In our desperate attempt to escape poverty, we painted targets on our back bigger than any prison sentence. Then, on an otherwise quiet day, Emma vanished from her cell. Guards shrugged off our frantic questions.
They got her,
Megan whispered one night, her voice breaking.
They'll get us too.
Weeks later, Megan disappeared as well, leaving only her blanket and unanswered questions. Alone, isolated, I knew it was a matter of time. One evening, footsteps echoed closer to my cell, deliberate and heavy. The lights flickered briefly, my pulse quickening. A guard appeared, his expression cold, voice low. You have a visitor. In the visitation room, an older man waited, dressed immaculately, eyes dark and piercing. He slid a photo across the table. Emma and Megan, both lifeless, eyes open wide in terror.
You took something from us, he whispered calmly. We always take back what's ours.
My blood ran cold. He stood, adjusting his suit jacket.
Enjoy your last few days, he said quietly. We'll be seeing you.
He left, and I sat, trembling violently. I knew there would be no escape, no reprieve. Every moment was borrowed now. Every breath counted down to inevitable end. In that moment, I understood that desperation hadn't just led us to crime. It had delivered us straight into hell. On March 4th, 2024, a shocking crime unfolded in Ashtabula, Ohio, when two women attempted to withdraw money using the corpse of an 80-year-old man. Karen Kasbaum, 63, and Lorene Bea Ferralo, 56, placed Douglas Lehman's lifeless body in the passenger seat of his car and drove to a U.S. bank drive-thru. Unaware of the deception, a teller approved a $900 withdrawal. The women later abandoned the body at a medical center. Both pleaded guilty to gross abuse of a corpse and theft, receiving jail sentences. Authorities also indicated an accomplice, Justin Duan Kelly. Lehman's cause of death remained under investigation.